Okay, this is the review session on Wednesday, right? See, I remembered to record it. I was just reminded of something. A few of you are taking 161 in the fall. Hang on to the Developology book. Store it someplace safe over the summer, because you will need it if you're taking HDFS 161 in the fall. You might also hang on to your exercises, the written things that you've done, because we will build on some of those in 161. 161 is called the social context of human development. This one is the family context of human development. So in the fall, we just pick up from here and do a quick review of the macro system and developmental trajectories, and then immediately start talking about poverty. And we apply Bronfenbrenner to the social context, neighborhoods, communities, schools, healthcare, social services. This course. Yeah, so once you pass 60, you're okay for 161. It's the only prerequisite. And it is non-negotiable prerequisite. I always have people who want in it. Oh, well, I can catch up. What should I tell them when they say, I can catch up with Bronfenbrenner? I've done it twice, and it was a disaster both times, so I'm not going to do it ever again. So if you pass 60, you can take 161. 161 is smaller, supposed to be smaller. I think there are 48 enrolled. Fair amount of writing. Actually, relative to this course, probably the same amount of writing, maybe less. Okay. And a take-home exam instead of a multiple choice, probably. Okay, so that was hang on to Developology. All right. Questions? Anything technical about the exam? Format is multiple choice, short answer, short essay. I don't know. How many multiple choice questions depends on how much sleep I get between now and then. So, Talia and I are meeting tomorrow, and it has never been so long that people took 3 or 4 hours to take it. So, because I just run out of steam after a while. Right. I don't know how many points it's worth because I don't know how many questions there'll be on it. Can I think of multiple choice questions off the top of my head? You know, I've done an exercise in some courses where I've had students write multiple choice questions as a way of reviewing, and then they turn them in, and then I edit them and I use them, and I completely didn't think about that. Multiple choice questions off the top of my head. No, I don't. What I would do is take something like Carrere and Gottman have their comments about couples that are going to divorce, and the characteristics that they see in those couples as they are conversing. And I would take that and I would pull out which of those characteristics, which of those characteristics are most important in predicting divorce for a couple. And then I would work that into a multiple choice question with some other fillers, incorrect answers. So that's one off the top of my head. Talia, write that one. And I would take something like, a comment that I had on an overhead at one point about how you get from stage to stage in Galinsky, and why there are different stages and what happens as you progress from one to the other. I would work that into a multiple choice question that essentially quoted that comment and threw in some fillers. A couple of comments about multiple choice. I never intentionally write a picky question. I occasionally write one by accident when I don't realize it's going to be picky, or I get tired and those sorts of things. But I try not to write definitional questions, you know, like this is that, because you should know those, and they're not worth asking the question. I try to ask questions that are straightforward and that require some application of the concepts. So there a few of them will be giveaways, but most of them won't be. But I don't write convoluted questions. I try to edit them so that they're straightforward. Whenever I add new questions, which I do every year, I will write one that's wrong, or you know, one that's stupid, or one that's so confusing that nobody can get it. That just goes with the territory. And then it's fun for me to see how you can write something that you fully understand and it's really clear, and then people start asking questions about it during the exam and you realize that you've written this completely ambiguous sentence that can be read two ways, and if you're really unlucky, it can be read three different ways. And is the exam cumulative? Yes, it covers the whole semester. Yeah, everything you've read. It won't be heavy on the basic developmentology concepts. I won't ask for definitions, that kind of stuff. But you're at a point now where you can use the Bronfenbrenner stuff more complexly than you could at the eco exam when I first gave that. So I will give you an opportunity to demonstrate to yourself and to me that you understand it even better than you did then. That was kind of basic level understanding, and now I think you're beyond that.
And second, as far as the papers that we should be reading throughout, should we focus more on what we covered in class and then use those to supplement it, or study it all?
The question is whether you should focus more on lecture than on reading, and I would say both about equally. It's always hard for me to answer that question. The number of questions will probably be about equal from reading and from lecture. But it's hard for me to gauge, and therefore I won't tell you where to put your effort. If you haven't done any of the readings, you're lost anyway, so don't worry about it. If you haven't been to lecture, you're lost anyway. So, but I recognize all of you, so you have been here and you do know this stuff. It's not, as I said somewhere along the way, I'm not out to prove how smart I am or how much you have left to learn. That's not my game. I'm out to give you an opportunity to discover that you know a whole lot of this stuff and that you can apply it. And that's the fun for me. No. The question is about picky reading. If I give you a concept from a reading, if I refer to a reading, I will give you both a hint about the author and the concept paired together, so you don't have to rely on all that memory. I know I've taken those exams where they just threw out a name and you were supposed to remember everything that person had ever done. And I didn't like them then. I don't do them now. So. And it also helps, if you've studied the reading, it helps if a concept is in a question, it helps if it's tagged with a name, because that's how many of us remember whose concept it was, and then we can put it in the context. So I'll give you enough detail that you can latch on to something that you remember. And sometimes it really doesn't matter who the author was or what the concept is to get the answer right. It requires interpreting the stems. As I said, they won't be picky. Hold me to that, Talia. Okay, anything else about the exam itself? Okay, anything else about anything else? What are the essay questions going to be like? Oh, I thought you wanted to know the questions. They tend to be questions like, I should have brought an old exam. No. Because I'd have to find one. The question was whether you could look at an old exam. The questions are likely to be things like, these are spinning ones, not well-constructed ones at this point. When I do an essay question, I try to make sure that it's clear and that I'm specific about what I'm looking for, so you're not, where do I go in the forest for this one? I'll at least point which path. I don't always do that, particularly if I ask new questions or questions in a form that I haven't used before. But questions like, Jess Thomas and Birch use the concept of goodness of fit. How would you interpret the notion of goodness of fit in microsystem terms? What does that mean? Okay. So then you'd want to take your understanding of Jess Thomas and Birch's notion, or Jess and Thomas. You didn't know about Birch. He was the other author, but what you have is Jess and Thomas. So don't worry about Birch. He's dead. But Chess and Thomas use the concept goodness of fit to talk about temperament in children and their parent, how you parent them. So I would want you to talk about the roles and relationships and activities and the pattern in the microsystem in a way that reflects that notion. In the past, I've used a question like, I refer to Galinsky's as a transactional view of stages of parenting and child development. In what sense is the, or explain how the stages of parenting are related to child development? Can I say that one more time? No, but I can paraphrase it. I always love that question. Can you repeat that? No, I can't, usually. I'd have to be listening to do that. It's on the web, or it will be. It was something to the effect of, if I refer to Galinsky's stages of parenting as a transactional view of the stages of parenting, what's the role of, this isn't the way I said it, I know that, but I'm revising the question as I go. What's the role of the child's development in transaction with the stages of parenting? That kind of question. And then you'd have half a page to write about that.
The study questions that you provided us with online, is that something to go on when we're studying?
The study guide?
Yeah.
Yes, because I just made that up yesterday. Or the day before. Day before. I put it up on Monday, as I promised I would. And what I tried to do was at least point to what I think the heart of the particular articles, the readings are. So, but it's very loose. Is there other questions? You want to play a little bit? Semester is going to end, I promise. The semester will end. What happens to your ecosystem over the next 2 weeks? What? It changes. How does your ecosystem change? How will it be different 2 weeks from now or after graduation or? Okay, so you are at least temporarily leaving a setting. Most of you, some of you are not. Role changes from student. Some of you will be taking summer courses, so you'll hang on to that. But the student role you abandon, perhaps, for a while, at least as an active member. Activities change. You don't have to go to class. You're not studying anymore. No all-nighters, that kind of stuff. None of you did all-nighters anyway. Positive affect. You think you're going to get happy. You're going to check the registrar's website online. You're going to see your grades. You're going to say, wow, I did great. Whoa, yeah. If you're a first-time student, you're going home, maybe. And you're going home to spend the summer with your parents. So you're going home. You went home for a break maybe a couple of times and you just barely made it through, right? Christmas, and now you're going for the whole summer. How do you feel about... No, that's... Okay, so it's okay for you. But for some people, there will be inconsistencies between the microsystems that have been operating here and the microsystem as it will be operating over the summer at home with your parents. And those microsystems are often quite different from each other. And sometimes it's a real drag. It's nice to have somebody else do your laundry and cook for you and put gas in the car and all those things if they happen. But the curfew and showing up for meals when they're served, that kind of stuff. Alice's isn't open anymore. Alice doesn't go home with you. Sodexo Marriott doesn't give you that huge array of wonderful choices, so you go home and mom makes mac and cheese for the fourth time this week. And what's likely to happen for many of you, and this is typical, is that your parents have been away from you for a year. They remember you when you were in high school. They don't know you've changed. And so they will treat you as if you were still in high school because that's what they remember. They'll fall into those familiar roles. So there's a tendency to recreate the familiar microsystem and they will be the majority of people in it and maybe siblings. So, yeah, that's a big switch. You're moving into that microsystem and there may be some jockeying. Some of you have little siblings who have happily moved into the room that you used to occupy. And they're not moving out. So you get the couch, right? You get the basement room or the loft over the garage or... Yeah.
There's a change in like the
The dyadic relationships with friends here are suspended. If you're an upper class person, some of those people you've been close to are graduating and leaving, and they're not coming back in the fall. Yes. Okay. People who are traveling will be entering a new cultural setting, exposed to a different macro system, different language. Where are you going? Okay.
London.
London. I have a heck of a time in London. Right. Notice how I said that. The implication is when I go to London, you know, for the weekend, I've been there once. It was last summer. It was hot, dry, no grass, no drop. How many of you will have the opportunity to get into a new setting, a new culture? Okay, two or three of you. Work on that. How many of you are going to enter restricted microsystem settings with molar activities that will occupy you for large portions of your day that are not very complex, not very interesting, and which you wish you could escape? What are you going to do?
I work at like Seattle.
Yeah. Barista?
Retail.
Yeah, but you get to see all the fall clothes in the middle of summer. And deal with all those customers. Anybody want to volunteer? Who has the worst job in the summer? Make photocopies, wash the dirty towels. I like that. Yeah. Okay. How many of you get to form new dyadic relationships in which you're the more developed person this summer? What do you do, Sarah?
I work with ADHD.
Camp counselor. How many of you are working with kids this summer? Okay. So you get lots of opportunities. You going to remember Bronfenbrenner? You going to engage in activities that can get more complex? You're going to gradually transfer power to the developing person? You're going to work on reciprocity? Yes? Yes, you are. Yes, you are. You're going to be better camp counselors or whatever you're doing with kids because you'll be thinking about, oh, how can I make this more reciprocal? How can I help the kid responsibly take on more power in this dyad? Well, after 161, you will. Okay. What else happens this summer as you go into summer? Ah. Completely new setting?
Living in Burlington.
You get to see Burlington in the summer. When the crazy people come out. We call them tourists and they spend money. The homeless, the mentally ill, yeah, we come out too. We're more visible. We're out all the time anyway, but we come out. And we sit on Church Street. And how many of you have never been in Burlington this summer? I strongly recommend that before you graduate, you manage to spend a summer here. It's just an amazing place. Very different in the summer. Music all summer, theater all summer, lots of wonderful activities if you don't mind being in the rain outside. The lake. It's a great place. Anything else occur to you as changing? How many of you expect to create a new primary dyadic relationship this summer?
Hope so.
All right, she's available. She's hoping. Okay. Summer romance. Joint activities. Yeah, it's become more complex. Positive affect. An opportunity to learn about somebody else's ecosystem because you're reciprocally sharing information and stories about each other. Right? You remember all that stuff about dating. So think about the process of getting to know another person. You can write your divorce agreement as a fun activity in the dating process. What happens at the end of August? Changing settings again, another transition. How will coming back this August, assuming you come back, how will coming back this August be different from coming last August? You will have inner setting knowledge. You've been here before. Okay. Familiar? I'm sorry? Right, the Davis Center. Actually, it's going to be open next week. I'm sorry. Oh, today's the 2nd of May. Right, okay. Has the bookstore moved in?
Yeah, but
okay. So yeah, the Davis Center, all that construction. And they'll have grass. They'll truck that grass in a couple of weeks. I'll bet they have grass by graduation. How many of you have been here at commencement before? Okay, commencement is in 2 weeks and a couple of days, whatever. And what's really fascinating to me is how much grass we can grow in the next 2 weeks. And daffodils and lilacs sometimes, depending if we have sun the next 3 or 4 days as we're supposed to, the setting will be transformed. And they will truck in a lot of sod around the Davis Center, I suspect. It wasn't supposed to be open until August. I'm pretty impressed. So coming back in September, you have inner setting knowledge. You have friends that you will be coming back to join. They will have been other places. And when you get together, you will have a new reciprocal complex activity, complaining about your summer. Say it again loudly. Very nice. Let me elaborate on that, because what she said was that you, over the summer, you're going to be adding a setting or more to developmental trajectory. When you come back in the fall, you're coming back into the same setting, but changed by or trying to make sense out of whatever happened in the summer. So some of you are going to come back from summer experiences with some change in how you come into school in the fall. How many of you are hoping that as a result of the summer, next fall is different from last fall? Right? It may very well be. Some of you will come having had an experience in the summer that tells you that you really want to join that summer romance at Binghamton, or wherever he happens to be, right? So you're going to start the transfer process. Just about the time you burn all your bridges here and get accepted to Binghamton, you'll break up. So don't do that. Don't burn bridges. But some of you will have experiences that solidify for you doubt that you already have about your major, or what you're, or the fact that you don't have one, and you'll be saying, okay, I want to do. For me, it was between junior and senior year. I spent the summer working with emotionally disturbed kids. And by the time I finished the summer and people told me I had done a good job, I had my new direction. Here I am. Same developmental trajectory. But it said, graduate school in this area, go. And if I'd not done that summer, I was going to be probably selling space on freighters. You sell space on freighters. It was a job I tried to get. I don't know if I would have gotten it because I went and worked with disturbed kids instead. But it's like selling advertising space, except you're taking reservations for space on container ships. This was a little before container ships, but you got a freighter that's coming to Boston on such and such a date, and you want to be able to fill it as quickly as possible and get it on its way. So it's a huge traffic issue, traffic engineering, basically, on ships. So you've got to figure out who you can go get who wants to ship something to Europe that's going to go on that freighter at that particular time, and then you bug them about getting it ready and get it to the dock because we can't keep the ship here because we got to get it out of the way for the next ship. And I don't know why that job appealed to me, except it wasn't in Illinois, and that was what I wanted. I wanted not to have to go back home to Illinois ever again. And I didn't. I don't have anything against Illinois. I just didn't want to be there. It's a nice place, but I didn't want to be there. Yeah. So when you come back in the fall, you're coming into a familiar environment, rejoining dyadic relationships that you've had, that you've tried to maintain over the summer by email, right? And will that work? Maybe. And then you'll get here and you'll try to maintain the relationship that you formed with the guy from Colorado. Now he's back in Colorado and you're here, and so you try to do that by email. So your exosystem expands to include University of Colorado, where your summer romance is, and the affect will get gradually negative and affect your microsystem here, and then you'll break up at Christmas. It's an old story. Sorry.
If you have a joint activity diet with somebody during, like, now they're in May, then you don't keep in touch with them all summer, then you come back, do you go back to the very beginning and then work your way up to the joint activity diet, or?
Question. You have a joint activity dyad now with somebody. You don't see them through the summer. You come back in late August. Where do you pick it up? As an observational dyad? As a joint activity dyad? With some people, maybe neither. With some people, you skip right over the observational. I mean, you just spot them and there you are back in your joint activity. And for some of those joint activity dyads, my guess is that you will think about the other person over the summer, which means it's really a primary dyad. You know, somebody you're thinking about, where is she, where is he over the summer. You may get in touch, so there may be some intersetting communication between you. And then you get here in the fall, and sometimes the absence has included for both people an opportunity to think and new experiences that you want to share. So the activity changes and it's catching each other up on what went on reciprocally. And sometimes that strengthens the relationship because it increases the reciprocity in it. Sometimes gives you an opportunity to increase the positive affect in it. And discover more similarity or more common thinking, which increases the reciprocity in the dyad. Maybe. The more equal power. Yeah, a lot of the overheads are sort of outlines for points that I want to make. And I won't get terribly picky about those. I would think about them as a particular overhead dealing with a particular topic. Think about it as a whole rather than try to memorize the individual pieces. They're the details that I probably won't ask about. I wouldn't ask you, to describe six characteristics of... I can't think of one of those overheads at the moment. But if I could, I won't ask you to regurgitate them. Ideally, and this is my goal, is that every question will have some specific connection to developcology and to relationships and or family. That's my goal, and that's again a Talia task. She's supposed to go through the exam and make sure that in fact they're all pertinent to the topic of this course rather than just random stuff. No matter how much random stuff I generate, it shouldn't be on the exam. We should be looking at the context of the family. If you want a couple of other exercises to think about, does the next class come in at 5? Yeah, okay, so we've got time if you want to stay. A couple of the other things that I would throw out as examples, and the short answer questions, these are kind of interpretations, but instead of giving you the whole description as we did on the eco exam, I'm likely to just give you a situation and then ask you questions about it. Like, so there you are, you're a high school kid, your grandmother moves into the household with you. What's likely to happen? So explain what happens, describe what's likely to happen to the ecosystem that you occupy as an adolescent when grandma moves in. So you have a different person, different role, a new set of dyadic relationships within the microsystem. People have different roles with each other in that. How many of you have lived with a grandparent? And what happened to your parents?
Well, my grandma did like the way my mom cleaned the kitchen.
My grandma didn't like the way my mom cleaned the kitchen. Yeah. Yeah. So, grandma would be in the kitchen, dad would be in the kitchen, mom, not in the kitchen. I had occasion to watch my first mother-in-law, who was a widow. And by that time, I spent some time in the summer with her when my fiance was not there because I was working in the area. And her 88-year-old mother had moved in with her. because her husband had died. And it was just absolutely fascinating to watch the 88-year-old criticizing the 50-something-year-old. Bernice, we don't do it that way in the kitchen. And it helped me understand why my mother-in-law, my future mother-in-law at that time, hated to cook. Everything she did in the kitchen was wrong. And it was really fascinating because they lived together for another 8 or 9 years, because Grandma lived to be 97 or so, 96. And it was just fascinating. As soon as her mother would open her mouth, the daughter would revert to teenagerhood. And she would mutter and she would drop things, and it was just fascinating. They're both long gone now, bless them both. But it was fascinating to watch this woman who managed her own household, had raised two kids, very competent in every way, in the community, very active. As soon as her mother came in the room, she became a teenager again. That those roles are so deeply ingrained. And I kept watching them, and even at that point in my life, I was only about 22, I guess. I kept thinking, why doesn't she just laugh? Why can't she just say, yes, Mom, well, we didn't used to do it that way, but we do it now. I'm sorry it doesn't meet your standards now, but this is the way I'm doing it, and that's nice. You can help with the dishes later. But she couldn't do that. She couldn't just take that completely adult, okay, Mom, that's nice, and pat her on the head. The grandma was really cool, too. But so what happens is that parents revert to roles that are more like the child role, and it's very confusing sometimes for children to see that happen. Wait a minute. Mom and Dad used to be in charge here. Now Grandma's in charge, and Grandma's half senile. What is going on? Who has the power in this microsystem? And so you can anticipate that kids' roles will change. The dynamics of the microsystem are going to change. Activities are going to change, because you can't do things as loudly as you used to because you'll wake up Grandma or Grandpa. Or you can't sleep at night because Grandma is up in the middle of the night clattering around because she can't sleep. You have things like that happening. More responsibility for kids, particularly if Grandma or Grandpa needs care, then you have the opportunity to be in the caregiving role, perhaps more reciprocally. Okay, so all of those are likely to be changes, more stress for parents who are dealing with with one of their parents, with your grandparent. And in most of those cases, when a grandparent moves in, you have lost a mesosystem setting. Okay? Because the grandparent has sold a house, moved out of an apartment, can't live on her own anymore, so she comes in. So the place where you used to go and have so much fun in the summer and at holidays, you no longer can go to because somebody else bought it. So there you are. So that mesosystem may have changed for the kid. Okay. So the basic point is that whenever you look at a family transition, you can interpret it and talk about changes that might take place in the microsystem and how the rest of life may change. Another one. What happens in a family when an 8-year-old becomes seriously ill? Okay, so there you are. It's November. The kid is in the hospital. We don't know what's wrong. Eventually we'll figure that out. And there you are. So what happens to that family? How does its ecosystem change?
Maybe the husband and the wife, the mom with another kid, possibly, you're also spend more time at the hospital than you do in the familiar setting of your home or other kids' activities.
So everybody's dyadic relations change. Activities may change. The mesosystem changes because you've added that hospital. Okay. Kid comes home, there may be activities related to care. Okay. Maybe a change in the microsystem because the parent who's spending a lot of time at the hospital isn't there, so everybody else is eating pizza, or you know, there are changes in that. The kid is eight, so the kid's mesosystem has changed. You're out of school now if you're in the hospital. So what do you do to keep up? Do you maintain communication with your third grade class? Does the teacher come to visit you in the hospital? Does the teacher send work for you to do? How do you keep up with that activity? You know, what's the connection to the setting where the kid would normally be? Let's see, we made this November. So this is the family that normally hosts Thanksgiving. So other activities are likely to change. You may need to bring somebody into the household to help, maybe a grandparent. So you need more adults. So all of those changes are things that you can anticipate. And they're going to require each member of the family to adapt to the changes that take place. So once you start thinking about those changes, then you can think about how they may be bad for people's development, and then you can start thinking about how they might be, how you might manage them to make them better. So if you look at an 8-year-old going to the hospital who has a 4-year-old sister, 4-year-old sisters get upset when an 8-year-old goes to the hospital, and the whole family is discombobulated and anxious anyway. So 4-year-old kids tend to fall apart, and they throw more temper tantrums, they're more upset, they don't sleep as well, they don't eat as well, they get tummy aches, they get sick, they refuse to go to preschool, you know, because they're showing their anxiety about that. So if you think developmentally, what does the kid, the 4-year-old, need in the way of assistance to manage the transitions reasonably well? Knowledge. Here's a setting that I don't know anything about, that the 8-year-old has gone into, and everybody's worried. It's a hospital. People die in hospitals. You know, the 4-year-old needs some interpretation, needs some information, needs to be involved. If you're going to change all the routines, then maybe it's an opportunity to help the 4-year-old learn some responsibility. So you engage the 4-year-old in joint activities. You make sure that you maintain positive affect with the 4-year-old to the degree that you can. You make sure that you hear the questions, so you keep some power, and so you give the kid some choices that are acceptable, and you maintain the reciprocity in the dyadic relationship with the child. All of that's going to be helpful to helping the child deal with the fact that her sibling is sick. Okay, enough food for thought? I'll see some of you tomorrow and all of you on Friday. Right here.